Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
KCAA. Loma Linda. 1050 AM. The station that leaves no listener behind.
This episode of The House of Mystery is brought to you by Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. LegacyFoodStorage.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Warriors
6.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is here.
Present. Yeah. How you doing, Al?
I'm doing good. So you haven't been driving into any Apple stores lately, have you?
No.
You know, stay away from that. That's terrible.
No, that's Boston. Not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody did.
Yeah.
I thought it was you. Crazy. For a minute.
Yeah.
No.
I'm nowhere near that area.
No, they don't let you in that area.
They don't let me there. No, they don't let me in.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. Got to stay away from that. And you're not wearing white when you go out, are you? It's after Labor Day. Okay.
No.
Good.
No, I looked that up, and it seems like, you know, it was to differentiate between the upper and lower classes.
Oh.
Wearing white after Labor Day, yeah. I guess it was like more of the working classes, yeah.
Oh.
According to what I read on you know, Google or Wiki or whatever it was.
Uh-oh. Well, it's probably true. If it's on the internet, it's got to be true.
It's all true. It's all, yeah, exactly.
Well, today we have a guest from Norway, and she's got a new book out called All the Blood We Share. Sounds pretty scary. So let's welcome Camilla Bruce. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Camilla, now you like writing scary stories or what's, it looks like you've written a lot of them.
Yeah, I do. I do like to explore the darker side of things, yes.
Wow. What happened in your life to make you want to do that?
Well, I think some of us are just wired that way, that we think we can learn a lot or find new things in the dark things that a lot of other people don't necessarily want to look at or touch.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that out there. So do you take kind of the common... let's say the common myths and beliefs and dark literature out there and dark fairy tales and stuff, do you take the common themed ideas and run with them, or do you actually make changes to them?
I do make changes to them, and I think especially when you think of myths and fairy tales, they do tend to change over time and have always done so, because society changes and people changes and we need something new from our stories.
Where do fairy tales come from in a sense? Where do the dark fairy tales, Like if it comes from society, it comes from folk. Do people just make them up? Like, and is it to like scare kids or into doing something good or bad? Like, why? Where do they come from?
I think part of it is that they are cautionary tales, you know, to make kids stay away from water or whatever. But I also think there's an aspect of it, which is that people really like to listen to or make up dark stories because they give a thrill, and especially in a time where we didn't have TVs or internet or that much entertainment, I think that listening to these stories around the fireplace sort of fill that need for excitement.
It seems to tie in, too, with a lot of things like, you know, occult and witchcraft and things like that. There seems to always be a crossover with that.
In my work, you mean? Or in fairy tales in general?
Well, just in general.
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, and I think that that people have always been fascinated with powers that you cannot see, things that are hidden and not apparent to the naked eye. So I think there's a fascination there. And of course, back in the days, there was also an aspect of caution there as well, because they did believe that these things were real, very real at times. So I think it was like sometimes you have fairy tales about wolves or bears or other things that can kill you. And I think stories about witches in some ways fill that same function. So you were to sort of know the nature of the beast. If you met it, you knew what it was from the stories, including the witches.
Yeah, it's interesting. So let's talk about this new book you've got, All the Blood We Share. Tell us a little bit about the premise. Like, what is the book about?
Yeah, All the Blood We Share is actually based on a true story, something that happened in Kansas in the 1870s. Early 1870s, and it's about a family of four who came there to settle, and no one really knew where they came from or what their background was, besides the fact that they came from Germany originally. So only one of them spoke proper English, the rest spoke mostly German, and they settled down in a very small house, or more like a shack in the prairie, where they operated a roadside inn. But it was not an inn like you think of an inn today. It was more like you could pay to get a meal and sleep on the floor, sometimes outside. So it was very, very simple, but also pretty common back then. And after they had been there for a while, people started noticing that travelers disappeared off the street, off the road. And they also found some bodies in the river and out on the prairie, left there. And slowly but surely, it became apparent that this family, the Bender family, had something to do with these disappearances.
When you write a story like this, how do you get into the minds of the characters, of the people that are involved? Because this is quite a while ago, and they're not alive anymore, obviously. So how do you develop a story around real people like that?
First, you have to look at what you do know about them, which in this case isn't really a lot, because they were there for only about 2.5 years. And as I said, no one knew their background for sure. They didn't really even know how the family was put together. Was it a mother and a father and two children, or were they two couples, or were they, you know, they didn't really know. There were a lot of theories going around. But you have to look at what you do know and what people said. And of course, there's a lot of rumors and lies in the wake of something dramatic like what happened with the Benders. And then you have to sort of try to figure out or see if you can see the shape of someone in that mix. And also look at where the story is going, what is happening, what is going to happen, and try to create or craft a character from that.
Yeah, it's interesting. What was your, you kind of come to the conclusion of what, when you look at this family, what do you think that they were really, practicing witchcraft, let's say, or bad people? Or do you think it was just all fear out of what people didn't understand?
It's a little bit hard to say. I don't think they practiced witchcraft in the way that people said, because that was it was actually one of the first things that drew me to the story, because it reminded me so much of European witch trials and transcripts from European witch trials, because it was, you had all these elements that you usually don't come across anymore when you talk about witchcraft, like shape-shifting into cats and stealing milk from your neighbor through rags and things like that, which sounds pretty much like it comes from the 16th century instead of the 19th century. So I don't think they practiced witchcraft in that sense, but I do think because the daughter in the family tried to make it as medium and a psychic, I think that they may have peddled some herbal remedies out the door. And sort of, that's an old trick, you know, if you don't have much, you claim that you have a special power or a special recipe so that you can make a little extra just by sort of feeding that rumor. And I think they may have done that, yes.
Yeah.
Did you have to do a lot of research into the occult and witchcraft to kind of go into what they were supposedly doing back then?
Yeah, there were like two strains there, because the rumors that did exist, they actually corresponded pretty well with written sources on witchcraft beliefs and belief in the occult among German settlers. So that it's clear that some of these old European thoughts and ideas came over with them. And that's sort of where I found this old school stuff. But this was also in the beginning of the spiritualism craze. So that was sort of another strain to follow. And Kate, the daughter in the house, she tried to be a part of that. So I did look into spiritualism as a religion and as a practice, because obviously they were connected to that. And I also figured out that sometimes, because back in the day, it was said that only witches could speak to the dead. So for these people who believed that, the mediums that started having their heyday in the 19th century, they had to be witches in order to speak to the dead. So there's a lot of mix-ups there and some confusion and a lot of superstition. So it was very fascinating to follow the different strains of occult beliefs.
So what did they actually end up doing to the family? Were they prosecuted for the crimes?
No, they were not. They when they figured out that the people of Cherrywell were onto them, they packed up and left. And people found their carriage, the wagon. They had this rickety old wagon. And they found that and the family dog and a lot of belongings, but they did not find the family. So it was a huge manhunt. And the press was following it closely. And there was a lot of reported sightings of the Bender family either together or one or two of them. And there were even a couple of false arrests because people thought they had found some of the Benders and it turned out not to be. So, but in the end, they didn't find them. So no one knows what happens to them.
Wow. That's, it's interesting. What makes you gravitate to a story like this?
I think that in my first novel, based on true crime, In the Garden of Spite, which was about a Norwegian immigrant, so that's why it felt close to me. There was this lone killer who did everything by herself. She set up house, she invited men in, and she killed them on a huge scale. But the Benders, they worked together. It was like a group. So I think it was the idea of how does something like this happen within a family? How do they interact with each other, and how do the family dynamics change when they start a life of crime together? What do they say to each other over dinner? I think that was what fascinated me most in the beginning. Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering how you create your dialogue, especially for characters who are, you know, historical and stuff. Are you pulling from anything from the historical record? Are you pulling from news reports or anything like that, from even other people who lived at that time? Or is it more imagination and just going down that road to create dialogue?
I know some authors, so historical fiction, they really try to make the language as authentic as possible. But my experience is that for a lot of contemporary readers, that becomes a little too difficult to understand, you know. So I'm trying to walk a middle ground there. So it's supposed to be accessible, but also have that old-fashioned flair. But of course, if I find a direct quote from a character, I try to use it because for the authenticity.
How reliable is the information when you get it? Like, because if you go back to old newspaper articles and stuff, I would think that a lot of the media would look at this family as something evil, probably. That would be kind of their perception. So they would probably report it that way. Did you find that was true, or were they pretty neutral?
They were not neutral. The press was furious that the police wasn't able to make an arrest. And of course, they did some pretty bad things. So I do understand that that it was hard to remain neutral. But no, I think that everything has to be taken with a grain of salt. And of course, after something like this happens, there's a lot of rumors that arise. And also, suddenly everyone has been at the Bender Inn and eaten and almost gotten killed, but gotten out of there through luck or their own wit. So you have to sort of sort the stories, what is likely to be true and what not likely to be true. But
yeah, I ate there and I got sick.
Yeah. Maybe something that's not true, I can still use it if it suits my story. So that's the upside to not writing completely realistic, yeah.
Well, what did they actually get accused of doing, or what did the townspeople think that the Bender family had done? How many people had they killed, or what was it that they had done to people?
When they had guests at the inn that they thought had money on them, because a lot of people were traveling with large amounts of money at that time to buy land or things like that. They would feed them and make them feel at home. And then, according to legend, one of the Benders would come up behind a curtain which they had, which separated their private quarter from the front of the inn. There was a canvas curtain, and the person behind the curtain would strike with a hammer in the back of the head of the person who sat there eating his dinner. And when he got sick from the blow, they would tip him back into a shallow cellar that they had under the house, and then they would cut their throat. And they did that several times. So in addition to the body that was found in the river and the two bodies that were found in the prairie, they found about 10 or 11 people out in behind the Bender Inn. So they were at it for quite some time.
Now, the people that they found in the back of the Bender Inn, how were they killed?
They were killed with first a hammer blow to the head, and then the throats were cut.
And the police didn't find any evidence or couldn't charge them with anything, eh?
Well, they ran away, so they couldn't. But it was clear that it was their doing, yes.
Were there any surprises that you found when you were doing the research on this story?
I think the biggest surprise, there were some of them. I was constantly surprised. But what surprised me the most was that it was them, because the people of Cherrywell, they were worried that people disappeared off the road, and they were suspicious. But they never sort of figured out that it was the Benders, and that's very curious to me.
When you finish writing this book and you get it out and stuff, does it change your attitude toward people you meet on the street or people that your neighbors?
I do think that maybe you get a little bit suspicious, but then again, it's very rare that people you meet are serial killers. That's the ultimate bad luck. But I also think that one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to these stories about the serial killers is because we think of them as monsters, which they are. They're definitely monsters. But I'm also curious about where is the human in the monster? Where does the line go? Where does the person end and the monster begin? And that's sort of what draws me to them, because I'm curious, because they're so different from us.
Yeah, do you ever wonder why a serial killer does stuff like that? And in this particular case, if it's all true, you have a family of four or four people that are doing it all as one unit. So why four people would get together and serial kill per se? Do you ever wonder how? And yeah, because I always wonder, how would that conversation come up?
Yeah, I think that the rumor goes that they already had a shady past, that one of them had killed someone in Pennsylvania. And I think that makes sense, that things like these, they are like accelerating. It's maybe start small or with just one thing or two things. And then you sort of, I think it's the same thing as in a cult, you know, that your boundaries are being pushed all the time because other people took you into it. And it's like maybe seduce each other into thinking this is not so bad if you look at it from this or that angle. So I think that when there are several killers who work together, they are able to coax each other into it in a way. I think they start small and then it just snowballs.
Yeah, that must have been interesting dinner talk around the Bender family.
Yeah.
At the dinner table, you know, like. So what do you think when you do something like this? Does this make you want to write another book in the same sort of genre?
Yeah, this is actually my second one based on true crime. I did one before on Belle Gunness, a female serial killer who originally came from Norway, from the same part of Norway as I am from. So she felt sort of relatable to me, in a sense, to a certain point, yeah. And it is slightly addictive because you get this mixture of thriller and true crime and historical fiction, which I think it's really fun to work with.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, you know, when you're doing these historical crime fiction type novels, how much literary license do you need to take to dramatize the story, or are you able to kind of stay in the, within that true arc of the story that happened in real life?
So I had to take a lot of creative liberties, but in my first book, there were a lot of more facts known, so I could sort of piece together what I had. But then too, you had to, you know, even if you know the facts, you don't know what they thought or how they felt or who they were when no one was looking. So that's things you have to make up. And especially in terms of motive, because it's not always clear. Yes, it's the money, but is it just the money? Would you do something so horrible just for money? And then you have to sort of look into them and try to come up with reasons that aren't readily apparent.
Yeah, it's strange, you know. How did you get into writing, period? Where did it start for you?
Writing in general or, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like writing books.
I think I've always written, but I was a late bloomer because I didn't get serious before I was in my 30s. And also because you know, I live in Norway and I've always been drawn to, as we said, sort of dark books. And I also write speculative fiction, you know, dark fantasy and horror. And it's not really a market for that in Norway. So it has been quite a journey because I also had to look outside of my own country to find my markets. I think writing and expressing myself in that way has always been something I have done and something I probably always will do. So it's really nice to finally be at a point where I can share my stories with readers.
Yeah, and America is always a good market to sell murder. there's always some people interested in there. Big market, you know. So where to next? What's coming up next after this book?
Right now I have been focusing a little bit on my speculative fiction. So I've been working on a horror novel. So, but I do have an outline for a new historical murder book, which I hope to be able to start writing really soon. Since it's not... nothing is decided yet, as they say. I don't know if I can share anything more than that, besides the fact that there's more in the room.
There's more coming. Now, do you do social media? Do you have a website? Do you interact with readers? And if so, what is the website and what social media platforms are you on?
My website is CamillaBruce.com. And I'm mostly on Instagram. And that's CamillaBruce_writing. But you can go there from my website as well. I'm also on Twitter, but not as much as Instagram.
Yeah, a lot of people don't seem to be on Twitter as much these days.
Yeah.
things are going on there, you know. But certainly interesting. So if someone had never heard of you before, what book would you tell them to pick up to kind of get your type of writing?
That depends on what am I writing you're interested in. As I said, I write in two different genres, and I know that not everyone who likes my historical books likes my speculative work and vice versa. So if you want to write something more fantastical, I think I would have started with my debut, You Let Me In, which is a dark fairy tale. And if you're more into historical fiction, I think that even though there's a lot of me in All the Blood We Share, I also think that you will get a better idea of who I am as a writer in The Garden of Spite, which was my first true crime-based novel.
Well, do you put a lot of your own character in true crime books, more so than this fiction, speculative fiction?
No, I think it's about the same, but different versions or different sides, I think. There are different, very different books, and I use very different parts of me when I write them.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and hopefully everything goes well for you. The book, of course, we were talking about is All the Blood We Share, and our guest is the author, Camilla Bruce. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Thanks, Camilla.
We interrupt our programming. This is a national emergency. Important details will follow.
Are you prepared? Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. Go now to LegacyFoodStorage.com. Use coupon code HOM15 now for 15% off. Quick, go!
If you're a fan of stories that make you afraid to turn the lights off at night, then you will love Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror. From attorney, former Air Force officer, special agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and Bram Stoker Award-winning author, Hank Schwabel. Moonless Nocturne is a chilling set of 10 tales that offers an exquisite and impressive showcase of the author's talents that are sure to entertain and intrigue readers who love a good thrill. With an introduction by the iconic F. Paul Wilson, Moonless Nocturne is a gourmet platter of both red meat and rare delicacies, not only for aficionados of horror, mystery, thrillers, and suspense, but any connoisseurs of fantastic fiction. It's inventive and original. This collection has already been optioned for television and film by Lone Tree Entertainment and is certain to appeal to fans of King, Barker, Matheson, and Jackson. It's not the dark that should scare you. It's all the things that lurk there. Order your copy right now on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Moonless Nocturne, Tales of Dark Fantasy and Horror, from author Hank Schwabel.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and it's a mysterious world that we live in.
It certainly is.
Well, yeah, every day I wake up and it's just even more exciting than the day before.
Yes, it is.
It is. Well, speaking of excitement, let's just get into this because we've got this Canadian writer and she's got another Marketville mystery, and it's before there were skeletons. So Judy Penn-Schillack, thank you for being here.
Well, hi, Alan. Nice to be here. And hi, Dave.
You know, Marketville, that must be a pretty... I was thinking about this. This is you've got a lot going on in that town.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty wicked. It's like when you watch those shows on TV, those series, and it's just it's just a small town of 80 people, but they have a murder every day.
Like Capitol, yeah.
I always wonder about that. Well, so
okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
How did this book come to you, number four?
Yeah, so there's three books in the series. The first one is Skeletons in the Attic, and then Past and Present, and then A Fool's Journey. And so Skeletons in the Attic was a story of Callie, the main protagonist, looking into her mother's disappearance 30 years before. And although that's more or less resolved at the end of the book, there are still some loose ends. And they're not tied up in books two and three. And I sort of felt like it was time to, you know, really tie up all those little loose ends, right? So my initial thought was to write a book called Before There Were Skeletons, which is what the title of the book is. But the thought was to actually place the book in 1978, the year that Callie was conceived, and tell it from her mother's point of view. And I thought, well, that'll be good. It'll be like a prequel, right? Before There Were Skeletons, Skeletons in the Attic. So I wrote probably, I'm going to say 75 pages, like a significant chunk of pages and words in Abigail, Callie's mother's voice. And it just was awful. Like, I don't know how else to describe it, but, you know, I'd go to it every day and I'd read what I'd written the day before. That's my sort of normal practice, try to write a chapter a day, go back, read the chapter the next day, and then soldier on. And I just, you know, every day I'd like dread a little bit more going back to it, thinking this is just not very good and it's not very interesting. And I just couldn't get Abigail's voice right. But what I did find is that by doing those 75 pages, I felt that I'd gotten to know her a lot better than I had previously, right? Because I got to know her as a young, like she was 17 when she got pregnant with Callie, and she had to drop out of grade 13, which we have here, had here in Ontario, not anywhere else, I don't believe. So anyway, I sort of felt like, okay, now I know her better, but I'm going to set the book in present day and somehow figure out a way to bring that past into Callie's present, right? So that was sort of how I ended up going to a present day with a nod to the past.
When you write missing person as a subject, there's got to be an evil character or some sense of evil throughout the town then, or somebody bad. Do you have issues writing an evil character?
No, not really, because I can be quite evil. No. I just look in my inner self and say, how would I do this? No. Actually, so the Hallie, her business is based in Marketville, but this particular book, there are three missing women. She's actually hired to investigate a woman who went missing in Miyakota Falls, which is about 40 minutes north of where she lives in Marketville, an even smaller town than Marketville. And this woman went missing in 1995, and her daughter, and left behind a one-year-old daughter. And it's her daughter that's come to Callie and said, listen, I know that you do this kind of thing. I want to find out why my mother left and if she's still alive or where she is, because nobody knows, right? And Callie is really intrigued by that case because Callie's mother disappeared on Valentine's Day, 1980, and this woman disappeared on Valentine's Day, 1995. So she was left behind by her mother. This girl was left behind by her mother. She feels sort of a connection right away. But as she starts looking into it, she finds that two other young women, roughly the same age, build, appearance, disappeared 2 weeks apart each in 1995. So three missing women, 1995, you know, over a six-week period in a small town. And so she starts, you know, she figures, well, something definitely has to be up here, right? So she starts, you know, digging and through the old, clues, tries to get information from the police, doesn't get too far there. And it just sort of starts digging like through the past. And that's, so that's how it now. And then where I bring Callie's mother's past in is at the same time that she's doing that, her grandmother, Abigail's mom, has approached Callie and said, look, I've got my daughter's yearbooks from, when she was in high school right through. And I'd like you to have them. And so Callie and her grandmother do not have a good relationship because her grandmother basically abandoned, her daughter and Callie's dad when they were, having a child. So she's not too fond of them, really. But anyway, she reluctantly takes the yearbooks and starts digging through them, looking at things. And that's where she sort of starts to learn a bit about her mother's life. And what she finds in those yearbooks actually ends up linking back to the 1995 cases in some way. So it's all rather complicated. Trust me, it was very complicated to write.
Are all of the missing cases connected in a sense?
They're not all connected, but there's a loose connection between a couple of them and a stronger connection between another, but they're not really all connected. Like there's two missing women in 1978. Those cases are connected to one another. And then there's the three women in 1995, which may or may not be connected. Callie's trying to determine that.
Is this like an alien book?
Some days it might have felt like that, for sure. But it's definitely got a more complex plot than anything I've written before. It just seems like every book I get a little more complicated. I don't know why that is, but you definitely, need to be on your toes to read it. And I definitely had to be on my toes to write it. So one of the reasons it took the last book came out in 2019. And generally I would do a book every year to 18 months. This one took longer. And one of the reasons was on top of COVID, which kind of, just messed with your head a little bit. I ended up falling on the ice and getting a concussion, and there's no way that I could keep that kind of a plot in my mind with a concussion. So I had to kind of put the book on hold until the concussion symptoms kind of drifted away.
Well, I was going to ask how you keep track of, a very complex plot. I didn't know if you have some tools or just some systems, or is there a way that you do that?
So I have the old-fashioned paper and pen notebooks. I like the ones that are spiral-bound because you can rip the pages out. So as I'm writing, I'll scribble notes in the spiral notebook with little reminders to myself, like, okay, page 72, Plot point needs to be resolved. Page 80, verify fact, this and this, right? So I make little notes, like even as far as the dates of the missing people, I found a calendar from, say, 1995 and looked at dates that made sense and then decided I wanted them each to be 2 weeks apart. So I went and I checked the calendar for that date, and then the full, maybe if there's a full moon on that date, I check all kinds of stuff like that. And I scribble all that stuff down in my notebook. But really, if you weren't me, the notebook would make no sense to you at all. It's just random scribblings. And then when I sort of achieved what I wanted to do, I put a big check mark next to it. So that I feel like I made progress that day if I get a check mark. And then once that page is fully checked, I just throw it out. Like, I don't keep it. So all those notes are basically in my head. It's not the most effective. I mean, it's not the best way of doing things. It'd probably be better if I kept better notes, but I don't.
Oh, God, yeah. Don't want to keep it in your head. There's so little to hold on.
I know. I don't know why, but I that's the way I've always worked. They're all just in my head, these people living there.
Well, yeah, so that's the alien speaking to you about this. This is all a plan, right? Well, but this is kind of, where does this missing person intrigue sort of thing come from for you? I mean, because that's an interesting thing. Like, you're, in a way, you're centered on it. So, like, the mystery of it, like, it's centered around missing people or why people went missing.
Yeah, it was started with basically with A Fool's Journey, which was the previous book 3. So I was reading my local paper at the time where I was living, and there was an article in the paper about a family that were still looking for their son who had gone missing in 2020. And this would have been, you know, like 2015, 16, 17, something like that when I was reading it. And he left home to find himself. He left a note saying he's gone to find himself, and they had no idea where he was. And so they had this article like 15 years later, we're looking for our son, any kind of information, we just want to know where he is, and that he doesn't have to come home or anything like that, right? And so there was a picture of him, like from when, 15 years ago. And it was credited to missingadults.ca. So I thought, oh, that's really interesting. So I went to that website and browsed around, and I was shocked, absolutely shocked at how many missing and unidentified people there are just in Ontario. These are only adults, only in Ontario. There's right now, I think there's 1,200 missing persons cases in Ontario alone. And I think 200 and some odd unidentified remains. So lots, we're talking huge numbers here, right? Now, some of those people left because they don't want to be found. That's the reality, right? They just want to start over. Some of them, substance abuse issues, some of them, dementia, some of them dead, death by misadventure, bodies still under a rock somewhere. You don't know. There's all these different scenarios, but I just found it fascinating. So I ended up calling the founder of Missing Adults CA, Lucia Dion, who is Lucy Danilock in the book. And she was phenomenal. She used to work for the Dome Network, and she does all this, and she's just an amazing, amazing woman that's just relentlessly pursuing, trying to put people back with their families or, provide some sort of answers to them. And so she had recommended two or three cases when I was writing A Fool's Journey, and I kind of morphed on that. So when it came time for this book, and I realized that once my Abigail, the main character idea, didn't work out, that I have to do something, I called her and said, I'm sort of looking for an idea. And she said, she goes, I know some cases that you can kind of look into and kind of, go from there. So she recommended a handful of cases, and I went and looked at the details, and there were cases of three women that had gone missing roughly at the same time. And so I sort of looked at those and then just made a bunch of stuff up because, you know, I don't want to, you know, what if these people are, you know, don't want to be found and I'm sort of uncovering them, right? So I never actually tell anybody who the cases are based on. But anyway, I just found it fascinating. I just find it fascinating that there are so many missing people. And we just don't think about that, right? Don't think about that. So anyway, that's sort of how it happened. And then she said, oh, there's these other two cases back in the 70s that have never been figured out. And so I thought, oh, that's how I can get, you know, Abigail involved. So anyway, and out came the yearbooks. And actually, the yearbooks were because we were selling our house and I was cleaning up stuff and my husband had some old university yearbooks. And so I started looking through them. And then that's when I thought, yearbook, oh, yeah, that would be good. Like, because, you know, if you have a yearbook and you look at people, like, you don't remember everybody that was in your class. And you wonder what happened to those people, right? Like, some of them, you know, I mean, all these years later, where are they, right? So I don't know. I just sort of took it from there.
But do they still use yearbooks nowadays?
You know,
do they still get those?
You'd be surprised. I think they do, but they're digital now, right? They're not like... you know, they're not the paper ones that you got. And, you know, because back in the day, you would have your picture taken, what, the first week or second week of September or something like that, right? Because they had to do all that.
Right, yeah.
So, that was the point of in the one, whereas Abigail, she's in the grade 13 yearbook, but, she drops out of grade 13 in, like, December because she's having a baby. So, that today you'd be... you know, first of all, she'd still be going to school because people didn't, you know, are more accepting of that sort of thing than they were in the 70s. But
yeah, and you see, and just for the listeners that know, grade 13 is an Ontario thing.
Yeah, it's not anymore, but it sort of, I think it ended in the 90s sometime.
You've got to have like a plot, a subtext, yeah. Some sort of a thing that you're trying to connect with people to think about besides, you know,
yeah.
Veronica Goodman and all that.
No, I would hope that it brings awareness to sites like missingadults.ca and the Doe Network. RCMP has a site, Canada's Missing, that they take a moment to look, because a lot of times there are, the unidentified, especially. That's what Lucia's working on now. She's trying to cross-reference people that are unidentified with the missing list and see if she can find connections. I mean, she's just like a tireless worker, but, something that was sort of really cool that happened with A Fool's Journey was that there was a character in there that was based on a real case called John Doe of Regina. That was the name of the case. And it was a young man's body that was found hit by a train in Regina however many years ago, long time ago, 20 years, 30 years, something like that. And he was never identified. And I used that case and referenced it actually in the author's notes with the case number so people could look up to say, you know, they're still looking for this John Doe Regina. And believe it or not, about a year and a half ago, DNA actually was able to identify him and return him or his belongings, whatever was left, to the family. Now, they've never made his name known. I mean, the family's chosen to keep that anonymous, as they have every right to. But they finally have closure, for lack of a better word, after all these years, because they didn't know what happened to their son. Like, to them, their son was just missing, but he'd been dead for years.
So are you going to continue kind of doing this sort of series with cold cases and kind of go into old cold cases and get ideas for them and kind of bring them to life?
Yeah, well, I'm going to stick with the cold case thing, but not necessarily another missing person one, because now I've sort of done that twice, right? Just can't do the same. So in the first one, you know, Callie, her Calamity is her actual full name, Calamity Barnstable. She's, you know, she's inherits a house from her late father with the proviso that she move into the house in Marketville and find out what happened to her mother 30 years before. And so she does that as an amateur sleuth sort of thing, right? With the idea that, okay, she does that, she gets the house. Okay. And then in book two, she decides, well, you know, she sort of quit her day job to do this finding her mother thing. So she decides to start her own company, Past and Present Investigation. So the second book's called Past and Present. And she is she's hired to find a woman that went missing in that was murdered in 1956. Okay, so the idea is like, well, who murdered her? You know, she finds out things about that woman. And then we went to A Fool's Journey and now this one. So yeah, I definitely want to keep with the cold case, but not another missing person. I don't exactly know what it's going to be yet. I haven't actually gotten beyond the, yes, I'd like to write book five stage, but I know it will be some sort of a cold case, just how cold and that I don't know.
Where to next then? You don't know. Are you going to do something on a different type of genre or a different type of writing?
I am. Actually, I'm working on a project now that is a nonfiction project, but I'm reluctant to talk about it because I'm very superstitious and I feel like if I do tell anybody, it something will happen, so I can't do it. You know, like I'm super superstitious when I'm working on something. So I'm hard at work. I actually have a notebook filled with scribbles and notes. and I've been working on that pretty much every day since, I guess, the beginning of September. But I was sort of outlining it throughout the summer. Although I'll admit that throughout the summer I was more golfing and not so much outlining, but I did do some outlining. And so I'm now, you know, hot and heavy on it with my notebooks and my scribbles, and I've probably written about 25,000 words so far. So yeah, so that's what I'm up to now. So it's a complete departure from fiction. And if anything, I would sort of put it in the, as sort of a self-help book, but not anything to do with mental health or physical health or anything like that. It's kind of a how-to book, I guess.
Well, how was it transitioning, you know, back and forth from fiction to nonfiction? Did you find that an easy transition, or how did that work for you?
So this one is really using a different brain. But before I was a fiction author, I was for many years, from basically 2003 till 2018, I was a freelance journalist and I also did, I was the editor of a couple of magazines. So one was New England Antiques Journal and the other was Home Builder Canada. So very different kind of magazines, but you know, and not sure if everybody knows what an editor of a magazine does, but it's not just editing. It's like you assign the freelance content, you determine the overall topic, theme, you know, what sort of articles are going to go in there. There's a lot involved, right? But then there's also writing some of the articles yourself. So for me, this is takes me back to that time, right? So it's because it's a different brain, because you're now you're working with facts. You're not working with just stuff you're making up, right? So in some ways, I find it a little bit easier because, you know, I'm basing everything on facts. But in other ways, it's more difficult because, you know, God forbid I get a fact wrong, right? And I'm writing a book of facts, you know. So I'm going to be super careful with this one. I always hire an editor, a professional editor and a professional proofreader. This one I'm actually working as I finish each section. There's going to be, I think, seven sections to this. So as I finish a section, I'm sending it to an editor that I've met through some workshops that I had done, and she she's sort of looking at the language of it, making sure that I'm, you know, the language makes sense and it's easy to understand. And, you know, because sometimes when you know something really well, and I know this topic really well, it's easy to make an assumption that everybody knows it, right? And that's not necessarily the case. So this editor is very clueless about the actual topic, but she's, you know, really good at, you know, making sure the language is smooth and all of that. Once it's done, then I will send it to another editor who is really well versed in the topic and make sure that there's nothing untoward, right? So it'll be a bit more expensive for me because I have to pay these people. They don't really want to work for free, but I think it's really important. And it's a crapshoot. Like it may or may not even sell. you know, who knows? But it's something I really want to do. And I'm at the point in my life where, you know, I don't really take on any project that I don't want to do anymore. Right. I did that for years, like freelance journalism and writing for magazines. A lot of the stuff was great. I loved, you know, interviewing people and learning things. And I mean, if you ever need somebody for trivia, I'm your person. I know a little bit about everything, not a lot about a lot of things, but I know like that little silly thing. So I think, you know, in that way, it's something. But there were, you know, articles I wrote. Like I remember the last one I wrote, and I said, this is it. I got hired to write about a guy that had a porta potty company, and I had to write about porta potties and make them sound interesting. And I thought, you know, I'm better than this. I don't know whether I am, but I just thought that's it. I don't want to do it anymore. So that went, that flushed the career down the drain, so to speak.
You could have been something.
I could have been something, yeah. Anyway, I mean, bless his heart, he's making a living at it, and that's great. But, you know, it just wasn't, I don't know. It's hard to make it sound exciting, you know.
Well, okay, let's let people find where they can find you. Like, you have a website and everything, don't you? Do you social media?
Oh, you know, quite the butterfly here. So it's judypensshelleck.com, so myname.com. And it's a really good website, actually. It's got, I've got some facts and fiction there, even a little blurb about the Regina Man and the updated, you know, link to the updated article on finding him, finding out who he was. And I've got some recipes on there and, you know, blog posts on writing and that kind of thing. So lots of stuff on there. And then I'm on Facebook, Judy Panshelic, Twitter, Judy Panshelic, Instagram, Judy Panshelic. So nothing fancy. I don't try to go on crazy names because then I figure it's harder for people to find me and, you know, you want to be found. Have not yet done TikTok. I think when last I was with you, Alan, you were trying to talk me into TikTok.
Well, yeah.
And I did make a modest effort and just decided it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things, you know, if you're not comfortable doing it, you can't do it.
Well, and also you have to understand, like, every minute you spend on social media is a minute taken away from, you know, your writing. Right?
Yeah.
And that is really what I prefer to do. Like, honestly, if I wasn't an author, I don't think I would have any social presence at all. Zero.
Well, how are you gonna find the people that you you know, capture and kidnap for your book?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
But that's, as I said, if I wasn't an author, like if I was just.
Well, you're still gonna kidnap people. You're just not gonna write about
it. Maybe that's it. Yeah, that's it. I'll be digging into, you know, really you have to be so careful what you Google these days too, because, you know, like with the Fool's Journey, at one point they suspect that he had, that the guy that went missing had a pornographic addiction, a porn addiction. So I Googled that. You would not believe the amount of things that came as a result of that Google. You know how sometimes you'll be looking at a T-shirt and all of a sudden you get like 50 ads for T-shirts, or, you know, you look at Arabic. Well, the same thing with the porn thing, right? I was like, oh, I was like, seriously, you have to be so careful what you Google.
Now, we're talking about Before There Were Skeletons. This is a Marketville mystery. It's book 4 of 4. And the author is our guest, Judy Penns-Shelleck. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Judy.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
How you doing? This is Gary Garver. In today's society, the majority of people are not getting enough sleep. I know I'm not. If you're like me and having problems getting a good night's rest, whether it's health or stress related, I have a solution for you. South Pacific Sleep Lab. South Pacific Sleep Lab will do an evaluation of your sleep pattern and will provide a comprehensive study so you can start getting a restful, peaceful night of sleep. They take all types of insurance, which will cover your cost of the evaluation, and they will even provide transportation to their offices at no cost to you. For more information, contact Tony at 310-999-1887. That's 310-999-1887. Tony even stays awake all night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so you can sleep better and rest easy. South Pacific Sleep Lab. Start feeling better and getting a great night of sleep today.
For several years, KCAA has been marketing the Youngevity brand of nutritional and personal care products. Our experience with Youngevity has been 100% positive, so we are pleased to recommend them to you. Regarding nutritional supplements, we recommend Pollen Burst in the berry flavor and Tangy Tangerine 2.0 in the tablet form. For regularity issues, we recommend 3-Day Cleanse, and for personal care, we recommend Morning Hydration Cream. You can shop online for Youngevity at www.kcaateam.com, or you can order by phone by calling 800-982-3197 and tell customer support that you are part of the KCAA team. Youngevity is an American company based in San Diego. Call Youngevity at 800-982-3197 and ask about monthly auto ship that allows you to buy Youngevity products at wholesale prices. That number again, 800-982-3197.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pouty Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit TahiboTeaClub.com. Tahibo is spelled T like Tom, A-H-E-E-B like boy, O, then continue with the word tea and then the word club. The complete website is TahiboTeaClub.com or call us at 818-610-8088, Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-610-8088.